Now we have buried the face we never knew. Now we have silenced the voice we never heard. Now he is dead, we look on him with awe. Dead king, dear martyr and anointed word. Where thousands followed, each must go home into his secret heart and learn the pain, stand there on rock and utterly alone, come to terms with this burning, suffering man, torn by his hunger from our fat and greed, and bitten by his thirst from careless sloth, must wake in flame to answer for his blood with the slow, moving, inexorable truth that we can earn even a moment's balm only with acts of caring and fierce calm. Head of an African, vital and strong, the full lips fervent as an open rose, the high-domed forehead full of light and strong. Look on this man again. The blood still flows. Listen once more to the impassioned voice till we're lifted on his golden throat in trumpet call of agony and choice out of our hesitating shame and doubt. Remember how he prayed before the task. Remember how he walked, eyes bright and still unarmed, his bronze face shining like a mask, through stones and curses, hatred hard as hail. Now we've silenced the voice we never heard. Break open, heart, and listen to his word. It was just after 7 o'clock on April 4th, 1968, that Martin Luther King Jr. was declared dead by the head physician in the operating room of the hospital where he'd been taken after being shot as he stood alone on his balcony outside his room at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. Probably many of you remember that day. A .30-06 metal jacketed bullet from a high-powered rifle had smashed into his neck, ripped off his jaw, severed vital arteries, shattered his spine in several places. The assassination triggered riots all across the United States. While in Atlanta, one FBI agent hearing the news shouted with joy they finally got the SOB. A manhunt started immediately for the suspected sniper, a Caucasian man in a white Mustang who was seen racing away from the murder scene. This much seems to be uncontested. And yet, 50 years after the death of the civil rights leader, questions remain. Many of those questions have been addressed these past 2 weeks by journalists and commentators. Has racism abated in the last half century? Is bigotry still alive and well? Nazis and KKK march openly in torchlight parades. Schools remain more segregated than they were in 1954 when the Supreme Court ruled that separate can never be equal. Jim Crow has been replaced by mass incarceration. And yes, progress. real progress has also been made. But in examining the lasting legacy of the civil rights movement, its successes, its failures, few have focused on the troubling question of who actually killed Martin. James Earl Ray was convicted of the crime and served 30 years of a 99-year sentence before he died 20 years ago. He said that he pled guilty to the murder after his lawyer threatened to throw the case if he took it to trial. Before pronouncing sentence, the judge asked James Earl Ray again if he were guilty, to which he responded, yes, legally, yes, insisting that there was a wider conspiracy than the prosecutors had ever looked into. 3 days later, Ray fired the attorney who had advised him to accept that guilty plea, and he began asking for a new trial, maintaining until the very end of his life that he'd been a patsy, that he'd been set up to take the rap for King's murder. Ray never got a new trial, but shortly before his death, he did get the attention of the King family. Coretta Scott King, Yolanda, Dexter, Martin Luther King III had their own lingering doubts about the investigation, and they asked President Clinton to convene a fact-finding body, somewhat like South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, that would promise witnesses immunity from any legal crime if they would just come forward and tell what they knew. That request was rejected by Clinton's Justice Department, which carried out what they called a more limited examination, saying there was no conspiracy, the case was closed once and for all. And yet, suspecting a whitewash, the King family forged ahead with their own court case in order to obtain a full and free inquiry into what actually happened on that night in 1968. Theirs was not a criminal investigation. It was rather a civil lawsuit filed against Lloyd Jowers, the former owner of Jim's Grill, a Memphis bar that was located near the murder scene in Memphis, suing Jowers for monetary damages for taking part in a plot to bring about King's wrongful death. The damages they sought were minimal, $100. As King's widow explained, this is not about money. We want the truth documented in a court of law. My family and I want to see and know the truth and to heal the nation. This case that they filed was titled King versus Jowers and Other Unknown Co-Conspirators. And while not all of the evidence that they presented in civil court would have met the standards demanded in a criminal courtroom, the 6 white and 6 black jurors heard testimony from more than 70 witnesses for over 30 days. Lloyd Jowers, whose name figured prominently in this case, was a Memphis tavern keeper who told Sam Donaldson on national TV that he had been asked to help with King's murder, with the assurance that there would be a decoy to take the rap and that there would be no police present that night. He said that the man who had approached him was a local mobster who would have a courier deliver $100,000 for Jowers to hold at Jim's Grill, the bar he managed, whose back door opened onto dense bushes looking out toward the Lorraine Motel. Jowers also said that he was visited the day before the murder by a man named Raoul, who brought to him a rifle in a box. in taped testimony to former UN Ambassador Andrew Young, Jowers went on to say that the assassination was planned at his bar, that several Memphis police officers were in on this conversation, including an undercover agent named Marl McCullough, who went on to work for the CIA. Andrew Young, who was, of course, with Dr. King at the Lorraine Motel that night, identified this man, Marl McCullough, as the one shown kneeling beside King's body in a famous photograph taken just after the shooting, apparently checking the victim for signs of life. Jowers also told Young that right after the shot was fired, he received a smoking rifle at the back door of Jim's Grill, and that the next day Raul came by to pick up this rifle. This contradicts the official version of events, which says that the murder weapon was held by James Earl Ray wrapped in a bundle, and that apparently in his quick getaway he dropped it in the doorway of a nearby arcade, and this rifle had James Earl Ray's fingerprints right on it. The trouble is that witnesses, including one of the defense lawyers who helped with Ray's defense in 68, who went on to become a circuit judge, and another eyewitness, they both saw a man drop this bundle with the fingerprinted rifle in the doorway of the arcade 10 minutes before the fatal shot was fired. These aren't the only irregularities. Fire station number 2 in Memphis is located just across the street from the Lorraine Motel. Two black firefighters who ordinarily would have been on duty that night testified that they were inexplicably transferred elsewhere, while Ed Reddit, a black detective with the Memphis police, who was also at the firehouse to provide security for the King entourage, was called off the job by Frank Holloman, one of his higher-up supervisors, a cop who'd previously worked in the FBI as J. Edgar Hoover's personal appointment secretary. Former Memphis police captain Jerry Williams followed Mr. Reddit to the stand. The captain had been in charge of forming a special protective detail of African-American officers whenever King's party came to town. But for King's arrival on April 3rd, Williams said that he was instructed not to form a bodyguard. Four other tactical units patrolling the vicinity of the Lorraine had also been pulled back, supposedly because some local pastor connected with King's party had requested it, although the pastor denied ever making any such request. There were other peculiarities, too. More than one witness said they heard a gunshot and saw smoke coming from an overgrown bushy area adjacent to the firehouse, but before the next morning, all of that bushy area had been cleared. All the debris had been removed by the local sanitation department acting under police orders. Footprints, spent cartridges, any telltale clues about what really happened had been obliterated within hours of the crime. Robert Blakey, probably not a name you're familiar with, but he's best known as drafting the so-called RICO law, racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations. He was a chief counsel to the U.S. House Special Committee on Assassinations, which in 1979 was called into being to look into both Bobby Kennedy and Martin's death. Blakey still continues to believe that there was a wider conspiracy, that there was evidence that should have been looked into in 1968, but by the time the committee convened 10 years later, was probably long gone. Walter Fauntroy is a name you may know. He helped Martin plan the March on Washington. Then later, as congressman, he chaired that same House Committee on Assassinations. He also believes there was a wider conspiracy based on classified evidence he was able to see before he left office, including J. Edgar Hoover's logs for the 3 weeks preceding the killing, indicating that the FBI chief had a series of meetings with the CIA and military intelligence, including from the so-called Operation Phoenix, a counterinsurgency force specializing in death squads and targeted assassinations that had been transferred from duty in Vietnam, the domestic front, to keep an eye on left-wing activism. Douglas Valentine, who wrote a book about Operation Phoenix, testified in the trial that Army veterans who were connected with this unit were in Memphis on April 4th with orders to keep King under round-the-clock surveillance. Testimony supported by Carthel Whedon, the captain of Fire Station Number 2 in Memphis, who said he was on duty that morning on April 4th when two U.S. Army officers carrying cameras and briefcases approached him, asking him for a lookout over the Lorraine Motel. Whedon took them up to the roof of the station to the northeast corner where there was a parapet where they could hide with a bird's eye view of King's balcony. Doug Wilson, who was a 25-year-old FBI agent in 1968, FBI agent, maybe a credible witness. He was the first to open the door of James Earl Ray's abandoned white Mustang. He gave testimony that when he opened that door, there was an envelope that fell out full of papers. One of those papers was marked with the name Raoul. Another had the phone number of the FBI office in Atlanta. He was young. He was alarmed. He was confused by the apparent FBI connection. He decided to withhold those papers until 1997 when he shared them with the King family. On the basis of all this and other evidence, the jury in Shelby County Circuit Court had to deliberate only 2.5 hours before the judge read their verdict. In answer to the question, did Lloyd Jowers participate in a conspiracy to do harm to Martin Luther King, the jury's finding was yes. And in answer to the question, do you also find others, including governmental agencies, were parties to this conspiracy as alleged by the defendant? The answer was again in the affirmative. Of course, many are skeptical. The majority of African Americans, I suspect, agree with the jury. Congressman John Lewis, civil rights icon who was beaten in Selma, says there was a major conspiracy to remove Dr. King from the American scene. Jesse Jackson agrees with that. Andrew Young is convinced that James Earl Ray did not pull the trigger. On the other hand, white opinion makers like the Washington Post called the Memphis trial a sham and a deceit of history. The divergent perceptions are a result, no doubt, of the different experiences of blacks and whites who are on the receiving end of the American justice system. Blacks might say that they have every right to be paranoid, given their history in this country. Well, many whites might counter that paranoia and suspicion fall well short of proof. As my wife, a criminal attorney, observes, the bigger a conspiracy becomes, the harder it is to keep secret. Is it really possible that so many individuals and organizations had a hand in this killing. I also have doubts. I sincerely doubt if the orders came from the White House or from the Army Chiefs of Staff or from the director of the CIA. On the other hand, it is well known that J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI did have a personal vendetta against King 2 days after his famous I Have a Dream speech in 1963. Then FBI Director of Domestic Intelligence William Sullivan sent his boss a memo stating that we must mark him now. We must mark him now, if we've not done so before, as the most dangerous Negro for the future of our country from the standpoint of communism. It was this same Sullivan, with Hoover's approval, who tried to blackmail King with a scurrilous, anonymous letter accusing him of extramarital affairs and bullying him to commit suicide. This letter, whose full text only came to light in 2014, read in part, King, you are finished. You will find on the record for all time your filthy, dirty, evil companions, male and female, giving expression to your hideous abnormalities, and some of them pretend to be ministers of the gospel. Satan could not do more. What incredible evilness. It is all there on the record, your sexual orgies. Listen to yourself, you filthy, abnormal animal. Whatever was on that tape, Coretta Scott King believed to the end of her life in her husband's fidelity. She believed that the FBI had manufactured evidence to stain his moral character. What's certain is that it was Hoover himself who conducted the criminal investigation into the assassination, and that the files on the inquiry will be sealed until 2027. What seems indisputable to me is that whenever agencies like the FBI and the CIA and the NSA and JSOC and others whose very acronyms may be classified are given a mandate to operate in secret, shield from public oversight, they become immune to many of the checks and balances that are intended to stem the misuse of government power. And it's not too hard, for me at least, to imagine rogue elements inside that cloak and dagger netherworld plotting an assassination on their own authority, knowing they had at least the implicit, unspoken approval of those higher up, but we can't really know. Maybe the best way to carry on and preserve Martin Luther King's legacy would be by working as he did to restore power and decision-making to the grassroots, to the people, to continue working as he did to bring in excessive military spending that's supposed to be protecting us from foreign threats, but whose real impact is often to draw our attention away from the real enemies of poverty and racism here at home. To continue to question, as he did, the legitimacy of legal institutions that seem to have strayed from obedience to the higher laws of truth-telling and justice. In the end, this question of who killed King, it probably can't be answered. The more important question is who's going to keep his hope alive. But I think we do have to look at the past honestly, squarely, frankly, not so that we can lay it to rest, but so that we can move forward with open eyes, with clear vision of the real enemies we face in the struggle for dignity and freedom. King himself helped to show us how. It was clear that the day before he died, Martin had somehow foreseen coming events. He'd reconciled himself to whatever lay ahead. Like anybody else, I would like to live a long life, the 39-year-old told his supporters. Longevity has its place, but it doesn't really matter with me anymore because I've been to the mountaintop. I've seen the promised land. Maybe the only way we can make peace with the ongoing mystery of his death is to do as he did, to keep our eyes on the prize, believing as he did that no lie can live forever, believing as he did that truth pressed to the ground will rise again.